You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
.07 on a Monday. Mike McNamara with you. Time to do Crossroads. So joining me is Matt Morgan. Matt, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yeah. How was your weekend?
You know, young kids, it's like you go from one thing to the next thing, and before you know it, it's Sunday night.
Hey, I haven't had you on in a week, but in a week much has transpired relative to the Marines United controversy that's initially serviced in the Marine Corps. It's now migrated to all the services, which should be no shock. It's something that we deal with in social media, in high schools and colleges around the nation. But I've asked everybody about their thoughts about it that has come on the program, so I'd be remiss in not asking you your thoughts about it, given your background both in as an infantry guy and as a public affairs guy.
You know, I'm thinking back to one of the things that General Droughty said when you had him on relatively recently with regard to the issues at the Recruit Depot. And, you know, leadership is 90% about seeing and being seen, being present, whether you're a platoon commander and you're in the barracks and you're being present around where your Marines are living and working. I feel like we should have seen this coming better. I can point that same criticism at myself. We had an issue a few years ago with another Facebook group that was engaging in extremely misogynistic, uncharacteristically deplorable behavior. And we should have used that as an opportunity to get our hands around this, and we didn't. So, you know, I can only compare the, you know, Facebook, social media to a big barracks with glass walls. And if we're not there, if we're not present, and the Marines don't know that we're there and we're present, then there's going to be a leadership vacuum, and these type of things happen.
I thought it was pretty interesting for the Commandant to go ahead and, you know, articulate saying, hey, look, I don't do social media. I don't really get it. But now it's sitting front and center. You know, maybe I should. And do you think that's part of the gaposis is that the people that lead the Marine Corps tend not to be on social media and, you know, really don't get it, don't understand it. And yet the junior Marines, you know, that comprise the majority of the Marine Corps have been raised in a culture that certainly embraces it.
Yeah, in, I want to say back in around 2007, 2008, so that's right around the time that Facebook's starting to blow up, I would teach a module at the Brigadier General Officer Symposium, the orientation program for brand new brigadiers. Right. Also taught at Marine Corps Warfighting Lab's Senior Leader Program, and I presented a great deal of information, and a lot of that included or would come to include information on the Arab Spring to senior leaders. And many of them scoffed at the notion that social media was going to effectively have the same effect on the information environment that the printing press once had. And that's not an overstatement by any means. It radically transformed the way people got information. We saw that effect reflected in the presidential campaign this last year. I mean, there's almost two extremes of the types of media you get depending on what your preferences are. You know, your reality is altered. So when the senior leadership would say, I don't do it, I'm not on Facebook, I don't get Twitter, it's like you actually have a responsibility to understand this stuff. I'm on Twitter. I don't tweet a lot. Actually, I tweet very little. But I have to look at it as the same way I would as an LPOP. You know, when I'm setting up a defensive position, I need to have eyes and ears out there so I know what's happening in the environment that I'm responsible for.
All right, so look into your crystal ball. Where does this go relative to the Marine Corps? So, and again, I think, you know, you see these things blow up. I think it takes about a week for the dust to settle and everybody to kind of shake it out. And often it's like, well, let me get smart on that. Like, I don't know that, and let me get smart. Whether it's the UCMJ historical incidences or just the technology and the scope of it itself. Where does this go? What does the Marine Corps do about it?
Well, I think from a public affairs perspective, one of the things that we commonly do is rely upon the tremendous level of trust that the American people have in the military and the United States Marine Corps specifically. The problem is that as these things continue to happen, that trust begins to be eroded, and it's much more difficult for the public affairs team to be doing their job if they don't have that trust. We have to be able to regain that trust, and leadership is going to have to address it.
Okay, let me ask you a question, though. Isn't trust more, and this is just me, isn't trust more something that we live up to by virtue of the way we handled the issue, not so much by the fact that we had an issue? Does that make sense?
Consistency in words and actions. Okay. So the commandant can say whatever he wants to, but if they don't see the response to that, an effective response to that that's congruent with what he's saying, then our credibility is going to become eroded.
Okay. All right. But the fact that we're having these issues, I would say, doesn't particularly erode the confidence. I mean, we are part of our greater culture, and that's where the stump comes from. It's us not dealing with it in a forthright manner and us not making progress on it that erodes the confidence?
The perception of that, for certain. I have a great deal of confidence in our legal system. Right. I have a great deal of confidence in NCIS. And I know that the leadership is examining this. These are, for the most part, incredibly intelligent, you know, and very talented leaders. I would suspect, based on my experience in the past, that the judge advocate, the commandant's judge advocate, has his hands kind of halfway around the commandant's throat right now. And for good reason, because the public affairs officers council and legal counsel are often at odds in terms of what kind of public action you're taking. I know that kind of parsing the commandant's words here, that General Mellor is looking desperately to avoid the same UCI issues that plagued General Amos in the corpse pissing incident.
Okay, UCI?
Undue command influence or unlawful command influence, and that is the senior leadership can't speak and engage in a way that would be perceived as presenting an undue level of influence over a criminal or potential criminal prosecution. So if he speaks too harshly, as in the case where General Amos was purported to have said, "I want these guys roasted," right. Well, then that means that they really can't get a fair trial.
All right, let's switch gears now. This week's installment of Crossroads, tell us about it.
This one was tremendously interesting to do. As in my introduction, you'll get to understand a little bit about why. But Walt Heller is now 94 years old, relatively recently widowed when we sat down with him, and was married for 65 years. Incredible story. And Walt's, you know, just a kid who, you know, at the outset of World War II said, you know, he wanted to join the military, and his buddy said, "Let's join the Marines." And he said, in his own words, "Well, hell then, let's join the Marines." Once he got in, he found himself volunteering for Carlson's Raiders. And he's got some great stories about that. In most of his combat, of course, he actually was as a mortarman after the Raiders were disbanded a little bit later in the war. One thing I will say that is noticeable, and you can kind of look for it in this interview, is that Walt, like many World War II veterans, likes to tell funny stories.
Right.
He likes to talk about the places he went and the different things he saw. But getting him to get into the grittier aspects of what it was like fighting the Japanese on Guam and Okinawa was far more difficult. But the positive side of it is that Walt was not uncomfortable using salty language, and I think a lot of his character comes through in this talk. I should note, too, he's interviewed in this case by a retired Marine major named Todd Sanders. Todd is not a trained interviewer. We just wanted them to sit down and kind of have a conversation because, you know, obviously the way that the Marines fought in World War II and the way Marines fight today is dramatically different in terms of technology, some in terms of tactics, but not so much in terms of character and spirit. And I think you'll get a lot of that out of this.
All right. So, Matt, let me do this. Let me, so I don't keep you. I'll call you back here as soon as we conclude. We'll take a break. I'll get you back on the phone and we'll get the, I'm sure there'll be some email questions. We'll get those answered. But, he ought to be careful about that whole volunteering thing in the future, huh? You just say, hey, what the heck? And you wind up a Marine and then winds up in Carlson Freighters. So, yeah, it sounds like you might have a little bit of problem with that volunteering thing.
Yeah, I don't think he was too surprised by what he experienced. I mean, the guys that he was with, they all felt like they heard that Carlson's was a hell of an outfit, and they wanted to be part of it. So his experience early on is a pretty interesting one, and particularly in terms of a culture within a culture, which as Marines, I think we all kind of see pieces of that here and there, particularly as grunts, because, as infantrymen, we are some of the most prideful in terms of our MOS in the Marine Corps, and we're also tend to be the most defensive. So.
There you go.
Yeah, all grunts, right. Talk about nothing more than being grunts.
Yeah.
And,
so. In high definition, too.
Right.
Who is he? Where is he from? What did he do? What unit? What company was he with? Really? Does he know that guy? Hold on. Let me call and find out. Anyway. All right, Matt, we'll talk to you here in about 30 minutes or so.
Check.
There you have it. That is Matt Morgan, the producer of Crossroads. And here you have installment 2 on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
The first thing most people notice about Walt Heller is his size. The 93-year-old is slight, just under 5'4" now and barely 120 pounds. But what retired Marine Major Todd Sanders first noticed was a bright blue Marine Raider patch sewn high up on the chest of Walt's well-worn leather jacket.
Come all you jolly shanty boys that work the shanty and go, come listen to my story and I will tell to you our trial and the hardships we undergo each day while working up in Turner's Camp along the Chippeway.
I'm Matt Morgan, and this is Crossroads. Two combat vets, one mic, and a few war stories.
I started up from Saginaw to go up the Chippeway. I landed in a place called Clare about 11 o'clock.
My parents were farmers up in Clare County, and they lived on back-to-back farms. One faced one road and they owned the other, but they backed up to each other. I started school late because we lived way up north there for a while. I graduated from Lansing Central High School in June of 1942. All us young guys, you know, we were saying, well, we're going to graduate this year, and before long, they'll be drafting us, you know. So the buddy that we just talked it over and said, well, let's go join, you know, and I said to him, we ought to join the Navy. I mean, it seemed like everybody was joining the Navy, not the Army. And he said, I don't want to join the Navy. He said, I'd rather be in the Marines. And I said, well, hell, let's join the Marines. And he ended up, when we got in the Marine Corps, he ended up aboard a ship. He was, everybody used to call a seagoing bellhop. We had an answer for that, too, you know. Last bell we hopped was his sister, you know. But anyway, it was just funny. He didn't want to go in the Navy, but he ended up aboard ship most of the time. I was 5'4¾", and I raised hell with the guy that day in Detroit. We came out of the sign-up, you know, and they had 64¾" on there, you know. And I said, Jesus, did they have to put that 3/4 inch down? And I just felt kind of embarrassed, 3/4 inch. He says, buddy, if that 3/4 inch wasn't there, you wouldn't be going to the Marine Corps. You had to be over 5'4" to get into the Marine Corps. We got out of boot camp and went to Mare Island and pulled some guard duty at the shipyard there.
Yeah.
They had a huge shipyard there at Vallejo, California. They were making all kinds and all shapes of ships. But they were a little bit concerned about not so much what somebody might want to take out, but more what they might want to take in for, what they call it, espionage.
Yeah.
So they were watched very closely. They had to open their lunch buckets and their purses and things. So we did that for a while, and they just, one day they came and told us, they said, hey, there's going to be some guys here tomorrow that are looking for volunteers for the Marine Raiders. And we said, well, yeah, you know. And especially this one buddy, he had heard about the Raiders and knew about them, and he said, oh, that's a hell of an outfit. He said, we should get into that. But you had to join with two other people. You had to join as a threesome. And so they warned us. They said, you know, if you're going to do it, make sure it's two guys you can get along with that you like, you respect, you know. So we did. We went down and joined up.
The other day when we talked about this idea of the fire group and how those two guys that you joined with was going to be your team for the whole time.
Well, they just said, make sure it's two guys you can get along with and, you know, you like and, you know. And the three guys, what your assignment was, one guy had an M1, one guy had a Browning automatic, and the other guy,
one of the carbines.
Yeah. One guy had an M1, one a carbine, and one a BAR. The Raider training camp belonged to Camp Pendleton, but it was out in the hills, and it was straight in from San Onofre Beach, which is the big
surfer's paradise. Yeah.
We were straight in off the highway about 2 miles. And so there's lots of gravel, lots of open spaces for the hikes. And it was a good place. But they had one little thing that they did. And when you went to lunch or any meal, you had your rifle over your shoulder. You had your pack on. And your pack, they didn't care what you had in it, but it had to weigh so many pounds. It wasn't like pipe in combat because you take, you know, everything you can. But it was, you know, a little load. But you had to have that, your weapon, well, and your mess kit, of course. But that's the way you went to lunch. And it was all living in tents. We never had a barracks or anything.
What's some of the drills or some of the training you did?
Well, I started right out with a lot of walking and that and a lot of shooting. And a lot of rough talk. I mean, they taught you that you're a Marine Raider, your life's going to change, showed you a lot of self-defense. Well, they showed you what to do if a guy tried to, you know, a guy would walk up, throw his arms around you from
jump you from behind,
just
yeah.
Go joking around. Or it could be some guy that wants you to steal your wallet or something. And they taught us how to break that, and that way is just reach around behind and say hello to his genitals, you know. And it works. I mean, you can make a guy jump back.
Generations of Marines have learned that as the grab, twist, pull. Everyone will remember, you grab them, you twist them, and you pull.
Well, you know, the pulling, if you take my wrists, unless you're a big weightlifter now, I can break right out of it. You go against the thumb.
Yeah.
The fingers, but the thumb, they taught us all that stuff right away. Well, you were asking about the Raider training. Well, it was just to make you think you were tough. Well, and try to toughen you up. You know, like you say, the strength and learning certain tricks. And, you know, we'd say the three most vulnerable places is the eyes of a guy you're going to fight. The eyes, the throat, and his balls. And, you know, you get into a man's eyes, you know, you don't want too much. Catch a hold on his throat, might impair his breathing.
Yeah.
But, you know, and of course, down below, you know. And some of those guys would say, if you're going to be in a fight, fight. I mean, don't worry about hurting somebody or something. If you're in it, you're mad and he's mad, you try to win. They also taught us if you see a couple guys jawing each other and you know, they're going to fight, and that don't go up and stand, start gawking like, oh, gee, I want to see the fight. He said, one of them might all up and knock your teeth out.
Yeah.
But it was just a lot of take care of yourself. You know, they had 20 guys. You formed a circle back to back. You weren't looking at each other. Everybody was facing out. Everybody had boxing gloves on. When the signal went, you better get ready because somebody's going to start plopping you, and you better be ready to plop back. And you're probably going to find this hard to believe, but I was always one of the littlest guys. Yeah.
So you say that you're not that big of a guy, and I'm 6'2", 230 pounds, and probably the first thing that I recognized when I shook your hand at the coffee shop was that you've still got an iron grip.
I got a pretty good grip.
Yeah, you do.
And in the Marine Corps, I ran between 135 and 145 pounds. You can lose a lot of fights, you know, fooling with them big guys and that. But I said I had one goal in mind, was that if a guy was going to beat me up, you know, and clean my clock or however you want to talk it, my goal was to get enough of him to make him glad he didn't have to do it again tomorrow. Just to maybe break him with a bad habit. Never had any trouble in a fight.
It's one of my favorite ideas is that Marines come in all sizes, but they only come in like one type, and that's mean.
Yeah. Oh, I love the pride that the Marines have.
After you shipped out, after you all finished training, and then you went to Pacific still as the Raiders, where'd you all go there? What was your first combat post out there?
Well, the first thing we did was we went to that island of Emeru, and we had no combat. The Japs found out we were coming, and they had left. But the Seabees also had come. They wanted to put a new airstrip in there because it was so much closer to Tokyo from where they were trying to do this bombing. So we stayed there for 2 or 3 months just in case they decided, well, we'll hit them some night when they're least expected. So we were there. We had foxholes and everything just in case. But we never had any trouble. We had some of the best fish I've ever eaten in my life. It was deep water right off that island. Our guys couldn't go down that deep, but the natives, we call them, well, you know how we are. We called them gooks, but the natives there could go down into that deep, deep water, and they'd come up with live tuna. Boy, they'd bring us food and this and that. And on that particular island, we fell in love with papaya.
Yeah.
You know, oh, is that a nice fruit? You know, it's just, we had never had it before.
So when the Raider Battalion then got disbanded and turned into 4th Marines, where did y'all go from your first station there?
Guam.
Guam.
Mm-hmm. We went back and took Guam back from them. And then another odd thing, I don't know if I mentioned that to you or not, I had my 21st and my 22nd birthdays on Guam. Now, I wasn't there for a year, but in 44 we were there taking the island. On August 13th, I had my 21st birthday. Then a year later, after Okinawa, we went back to Guam because they wanted that new airstrip there and all this and that. But we went back to Guam, and boy, I love Guam. It was a beautiful island, and the climate was really great, you know, and everything.
Was Guam the first island where you had one-on-one combat with the Japanese?
Yeah, because Emeru, there was no
security.
They weren't there. Let's see, did we go to an, yeah, I think Guam. But that woke us up, you know.
How so?
They were there,
waiting
for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where I had the flamethrower. But I only used it a day or two and then never saw it again.
Yeah.
We were back in our mortar squad. And, you know, I loved the mortars, too. I wasn't too hard to please. I liked the girls. No, I'll tell you, though, the natives on those islands were just deathly afraid of men because I think they thought we would treat them like the Japanese had, raping the women, even young little girls, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, and beating the hell out of the men. But we never treated them that way. We would give them, they loved our soap. They didn't have good soap. A lot of those places, they claimed they made their own soap. But they loved our soap, Lux and Palmolive. But, you know, a lot of those, and especially on Guadalcanal, coconut trees, coconut palms. And most of those were owned by the Palmolive Peak Company. But those poor people over there didn't have that. The women wanted soap, and the others and the kids wanted our cigarettes. You'll see in some of those pictures I got on that Savile Island that we went to, little kids, 7, 8, 9 years old, the first thing they asked us was for cigarettos. And we got pictures of them, and they got cigarettes behind their ears. You know, they didn't have pockets. You know, they're living in the tropics, didn't wear much clothing. But they would try to keep the women away from us.
I love these pictures, and I always say whenever I see pictures from Marines, it doesn't matter. It's like you know immediately there's just Marines. Like you could take guys that I served with. Mm-hmm. In Iraq and put them on an island here in Guam. You could put them in the woods in France. You could put them anywhere.
Yeah.
And you just know that these guys are just Marines.
There's some hellish guys in some of those pictures.
I imagine. That's the other thing is you immediately remember the stories of your guys and what they did. And
Well, there's a lot of those guys that aren't with us anymore. In fact, some of them are gone. Shortly after the pictures were taken, probably.
Come all you bold sailors that follow the lakes on an iron ore vessel you're living to make. I shipped in Chicago, bid adieu to the shore, bound away to Escanaba for red iron ore. Very down, down.
By Owner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Listen up, employers. Veterans can be a great asset to your company or organization. Veterans have gained skills in leadership, teamwork, and performance under pressure. Veterans have received the very best training in their fields and are never afraid to tackle a tough situation to accomplish the mission. If you are looking to hire a veteran, the Department of Labor can help you make it happen. You hire a veteran today, you won't be sorry.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marine.
On Veterans Day, the nation honors the men and women who risk their lives to protect our freedom. Social Security does its absolute best to honor veterans and active duty members of the military every day by giving them the respect they deserve. For those who return home with injuries, Social Security is a resource they can turn to. If you know any wounded veterans, please let them know about Social Security's Wounded Warriors website. The Wounded Warriors website answers many commonly asked questions and shares other useful information about disability benefits, including how veterans can receive expedited processing of disability claims. Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
On a Monday, we continue with a segment known as Crossroads, produced by Matt Morgan, and you're going to hear part two from a gentleman by the name former Marine. I know there's no such thing as former Marines, but and his name is Walt Heller. So more of his incredible story of joining the Marine Raiders. And interesting stuff. I didn't know you had to join in groups of three. And I'd never heard the seagoing bellhop. The only bell I've hopped is your sister. Holy smoke, that's awesome. So more of a Walt Heller coming up right now, part two.
So I'd love to hear about your experience on Okinawa.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a whole new thing. I told you we walked into Emeru like we owned it. No, Okinawa, boy, I tell you, they put up one hell of a fight. And they've done a lot of night fighting. Well, that screws us up because we don't know where we're at night. You know, yeah. You move so far, you're taking real estate. And you go so far each day, that's your goal, you know. And another funny thing, oh boy, could they have used these radios where you just hit the button. But, you know, it was all string wire.
Yeah.
And those poor wire stringers had a hell of a job.
It's amazing how much combat's changed to where now we operate almost only at night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
well, sure.
The
Japanese said they loved night fighting, but they had been there and they knew the area, the terrain, the what's here, what's there, and they were very, very good at being quiet, you know. There was never one man in a foxhole. Always had to be two. And if there was, you come up an odd man, then there was three in one of them, mm-hmm. you know. But sometimes there are a couple guys, a couple teams get together and they'd have three in two or three foxholes they wanted. They didn't care as long as you had your weapons there. But you had grenades and weapons and things like that. But those guys could sneak up and drop grenades in your foxhole. They just were quiet and that. But we nailed a lot of them doing that, yeah. too, you know. One night, a guy that we didn't even like, he was a loudmouth and a smart kid. We added up all the stories he told. He'd had to have been 117 years old to have done everything the little bastard said he had done, you know. Five or six Japs came in a couple little groups. And he was standing there. You had to have one man awake, and that don't mean in the foxhole.
Yeah.
If the guys in the foxhole want to stay awake, go ahead. But you had one man up almost, according to how big an area you had, but it was, you know, might be more than one. But he had the guard duty for a couple hours. And these guys came in, and nobody had heard a thing. Of course, it was, you know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, the first thing I heard was somebody say, halt, juice or something, and then pow, 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 pow. And he hit three guys, and he was a guy we didn't like, the braggart, but boy, he done some good shooting. They weren't very far from him. But he did some good shooting, and those three guys were touching each other when they fell and left. I mean, they didn't run anywhere, or, you know, but he did a hell of a job. We started liking him a little better.
I was going to say, did his stock go up a little bit with you guys?
Yeah. He was from Texas, so naturally, everybody called him Tex. But he'd talk about drinking whiskey, you know, and getting drunk. And here this guy is barely old enough to be in the Marine Corps, you know. So one night he was talking, going on and on, and I just got sick of it. And I said, Tex, I said, do you really like whiskey? And he says, Heller, I'd live on it if I could get it. And you fast. You're probably just barely over 70.
These stories are funny because, you know, again, you could be sitting anywhere. You could be sitting in an outpost in Afghanistan or sitting in Iraq or sitting on in Incheon or any place. Yeah. And you hear the same stories.
Oh, yeah.
Same Marines, different times.
Yeah. And, you know, some of those guys are going to lie, but who cares? Hell, you got to keep talking. We had a little deal going there on Okinawa. But like I say, you got to be a little bit crazy to keep from going insane, you know. But if you can laugh and make fun, you know, it's better than going around with a long face and worrying all the time. But we'd get up out of our foxholes in the morning, you know, and start and get around. You know, you're going to start moving pretty quick. I look over another, you know, down a couple of ounces. Some guy'd say, damn, are you still alive? You know, you didn't get killed. It was just a joke. I mean, fart around, you know, light in the moment.
Yeah.
Well, this one guy had I imagine what you'd call a hell of a nightmare one night. But he had been in combat. He had been a raider, and he had been in combat. And he was a nice, quiet guy, you know. But, boy, this guy just went into a frenzy, and he was yelling, and he kept saying, here they come, here they come. And, everybody was waking up, and a couple guys were saying, slug him, you know, shut him up.
Yeah.
But everybody had a different reaction. But it woke everybody from tents all around with that noise, you know. But finally, they got a hold of him, got him settled down, talked to him. They were laughing about it. Everything was going good. And everybody wanted to get back to sleep. So everything's quieting right down, and you're just thanking the Lord that it's over, you know. And somebody yelled out, his name was Fry. Somebody yelled out and said, hey, Fry, did you get any souvenirs? Well, now it's laughter again. You got to keep it light and having a good time, you know.
I'll tell you a story about one time I was on ship. I was off the coast of Libya, and it was during when we were first going in against Gaddafi, and, mm-hmm. and I was on the Navy staff then, and I was in quarters in my bed that was real close, so mm-hmm. the beds, the bunk was right there in front of yeah. my face, and we were stacked in, and there were six of us stacked in this room, and everyone was going to sleep. At some point in the night, I kind of woke up, and I'm standing in the middle of the room in like a boxing stance, and I'm breathing heavy, and
you're
my
ready
buddies,
for me.
My buddies are looking at me, and they're kind of like, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm fine." They said, "Well, so a couple minutes ago, we heard you yell, and then you started boxing and punching the rack above you, in which my buddy was sleeping on." So, and like I said, I'm not a small guy, and as I was punching, I was actually, like, denting the metal above my
yeah,
bed.
Yeah.
And at some point, I had rolled out onto the floor, and we all kind of sat there and looked at each other, and my one buddy looked over at me and said, "Man, I tell you what, you kicked that bed's ass, you know."
You won that fight.
Yeah, I won that fight. So.
You gotta make sure you win.
I haven't won a lot of fights, but that bed lost.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I'll tell
yeah.
you that.
Oh,
yeah.
You got to tear them up. Yeah. We'd only been back to Guam from Okinawa a few weeks. And they came around and before we hit the sack. That, but it was also the first time we'd ever had wooden decks and bunks. We had bunks. But on Guadalcanal and those other places, well, the other islands and things, you didn't have a bunk. You slept, you know, on the ground or in a foxhole doing it. But we had wooden floors and bunks, and boy, it was great. You know, it was like being home. But they said, "We're going to move out in 2 days, pack up, get all your gear ready to go." And the only thing we could think is, well, we all talked it over. Everybody had an opinion. We thought Formosa, because that's next on the line to get
the Chain Islands, yeah.
We were beating our gums and everything. But finally that morning, they told us we were going to move out. But we hadn't been out there very long. The next morning, a guy got on the loudspeaker and he just said, "Now hear all Marines, hear this. All Marines, hear this." So, you know, he started listening. And he said, there was just dead silence for him. He said, "We got some news for you guys." We said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "World War II has ended. The Japanese have surrendered." And for the next 10 minutes, all you could hear was noise. I mean, those guys were yelling and hitting each other and just whistling and going over, "I told you, you son of," you know, and I mean, you know, there had been talk, you know, but, oh my God, bedlam, you know. That was some of the best news we ever heard in our lives, you know. And then he went on to tell us that we were going to Japan. And then they told us, our people told us, no raping, no, you know, you're going to have live ammo, but no accidental discharges, no fooling around, and, you know. And I enjoyed the time there, and I'm glad to be able to say I went to Japan, you know. And the people never gave us any trouble. And there was one bad thing. Those damn girls wanted 10 yen if you were going to lay down with them. 66 and two-thirds cents. And they had signs out on houses, "Short time, 10 yen. And that meant don't stay all damn night. I mean, you know, there's as many laughs as there are sad tales. And if you can't find some laughs, you're in sad ass shape, you know.
I agree.
There were a few guys like that. We had one guy, the poor guy, and he had been in combat before I got there. He was probably, well, wherever they were, New Caledonia, probably, or not, well, he was, no, that's where I saw him, New Caledonia.
New Georgia?
Yeah, he had been where, you know, where they had been. But he got, you could tell, they used to call it Asiatic. He's Asiatic. He's, well, it meant a little disturbed. And he just wasn't a guy that fit in good. Like a lot of guys, if he said something or felt sorry for him or something, he'd tell you to go to hell, you know. He always had a sad face and this and that. So, but somebody'd say to him, well, how you doing today, George, or something like that, you know, and he'd say, well, they tell me I'm going home pretty soon, you know. Well, they probably told him that to make him feel better, you know, or something. But he did, and we felt sorry for him. But other than that, I mean, nobody ever said anything about that to him. But I was never much of a gum beater. I said, hell, take it and, you know, live with it. And hell, you could read. I brought some of my letter, but I got a big box of letters home that I had written home, and my sisters and my mother saved them all. Thank God, and I've read them, you know. But I was just glad to be a Marine, and the guys I was with. And there were a couple you didn't get along with all the time, but, you know, there's always a couple guys that disagree, but I was with one hell of a bunch of guys, and they would look out for you, and you wanted to look out for them. That's the way I felt about it, you know. Semper Fi, gung ho, and see you on the beach. That's what we'd yell to the guys, you know, as we were disembarking, you know. Sometimes the guys would yell right then and say, hey, Joe, see ya, buddy, and see ya on the beach, or, you know, or good luck, and, you know. But if you'd went with, you know, a long face and up, and, oh, you know, you don't do it that way, you know. Well, you know that from being in combat. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So, I'm not sorry for a minute. And I'm glad there's guys like you around.
Second installment of a series here that Matt Morgan produces, and the series is called Crossroads. Matt, talk to us about your thoughts listening to that. I don't know that I've ever heard an interview with somebody that was part of the Raiders.
Well, you know, one thing it occurred to me as we were sitting here, I was remembering the full interview when we did it, and he touched on it just a little bit. He's talking about going into Japan as the occupation force.
Right.
And it goes back to what you were talking about in your first hour with regard to the necessary changes to the UCMJ to reflect, you know, the emergence of revenge porn. And Walt told us that when they received their general orders for going into Japan under occupation, they were told that the penalty for rape will be hanging. So, I mean, I was like, wow, that was kind of interesting that they're just going to go right out with it. Rape, death penalty. So it was a pretty amazing to hear him talk a little bit about that, the realities of occupation and what they're going to be facing. But I didn't know a whole lot about the formation of the Raiders and what you talked about, as well as joining groups of three. So that was interesting to hear, and that those guys really kind of stuck together for a large part of the war after that.
The other thing that's interesting is, you know, you can hear almost his reluctance. You know, he wants to talk about the good things, doesn't he?
Yeah, you know, The first time I met Walt was at a Marine Corps breakfast, Marine Corps birthday breakfast, in some local small town here. And he stopped, obviously the only Marine, he was the old, I think, the time, and he stood up and told the story of when he was on ship. Same story he told in the interview about the ship's captain coming over the 1MC, or as he called it, the loudspoker, which I thought was interesting regionalism. But when he talked about the captain coming over the 1MC, I mean, the emotion welled up in him. And tears spilled down his cheeks as he talked about that moment, because they thought that they were, I mean, when they boarded ships, they thought, okay, this is it. We're going to the mainland, and we're probably not going to come out of this. So to get on ship and hear the news that the war was over was a pretty dramatic moment for him.
It means the death sentence had been lifted.
Yeah. Yeah, you think about that experience, and if you've made it through Guam and Okinawa, you're probably figuring you don't have many coin flips left.
Right. At some point, you know, and I think everybody who's around combat for any length of time knows that you know, luck is a greater determining factor than any type of skill, and at some point, everybody's luck runs out, and I think it's kind of interesting. In Band of Brothers, I think it's that Lieutenant Spear who talks to a young trooper by the name of Blythe, who's having hysterical blindness after they jump into Normandy. And, when he gets nervous and scared, he goes blind, and he looks at Blythe and he says, you know, Blythe, until you accept the fact that you're already dead, you'll never be able to function as a soldier. And you hear that stuff, and it's like, you know what? The pearls of wisdom that are sown in that by guys who actually had that experience and knew what it was like to deal with that kind of, you know, mental burden on a daily basis, it's so rich in those kind of things that something really incredible. And you can, you know, obviously in his reluctance, and then as you recall, his emotion relative to that simple, you know, announcement, you know, attention all Marines. That death sentence that had you in that place mentally has now been lifted. And you're probably going to get home, which, you know, I'm sure that they had discussed the probability of that, and everybody had put that pretty low. And as he said, what was coming? The invasion of Formosa, and then what was after that? The invasion of mainland Japan, you know.
Right.
William
Manchester, in Goodbye Darkness, has a famous line where he says, he writes, thank God for the A-bomb, because without it, we all surely would have died. And that was the mindset. I still talk, even when I was doing the EWO documentary, I talked to Colonel Severance, and he expressed that exact sentiment, thank God for the A-bomb.
Oh, my God, can you imagine? I mean, you know, and I'm sure the other lament is if they could only have dropped it sooner. You know, how many more people on both sides would have been alive? And,
that's a good segue, Mac, the subject for next week, and the interview with Ned Seath. And this is actually going to be a two-parter, because we sat down with Ned for over 2 hours, and there's so much good stuff there. I didn't want to chop it all down into 30 minutes. But Ned, he was a machine gunner. He was actually a machine gun section leader in Vietnam, and would ultimately receive the Navy Cross for his actions on one night when his company was being attacked by an NVA regiment. But Ben Bush, who's also a retired Marine major who is interviewing him, asks him, you know, if he ever thought of home. And Ned tells him quite clearly, I never did, because I never thought I'd see it again. He had very clearly resolved the fact that he would never leave Vietnam.
Wow. You know, and that voice, you know, it talks to you all the time, too. And so the constant narrative of life and death as you see, you know, and again, you know, I think Matt and I talked about once, you know, the God who governs the flight of metal through the air is a fickle God, you know, why it hits one person and misses another, why this kills this guy but doesn't kill this guy. The fact that it wasn't aimed at anybody, it was just fired and it hit somebody. All are part of your daily existence.
I was at the international zone in 2007, and they had just started putting in these CRAM systems, you know, the warning systems for incoming.
Right.
And you'd hear that klaxon and the voice, you know, that would yell incoming. And you hit the deck or you dive for cover, and there's just that little piece in the back of your head that, you know you've got seconds here before rounds are impacting. And you're wondering where they're going to fall. So.
Yeah. No, and just that uncertainty.
It's a vulnerable moment.
Yeah, just that uncertainty, and, you know, that's the way you live your life. And so interesting stuff. Well done, Matt. Well done. Is there any other footnotes relative to this story that we ought to be aware of?
You know, Walt is such a little and unassuming guy, and it's funny because a lot of people that grew up in town, my wife grew up in town, used to see him running. She was running cross country, and so she would pass him on some of the trails and stuff. And, you know, he was running well into his 60s, just a tiny little guy, so unassuming. And he walks around with that leather jacket with a Marine Raider patch on it, and it makes me wonder how many people pass him on a day-to-day basis and have no idea. Just absolutely no idea.
All right. Matt, anything else exciting going on this week?
That's it, man. That's it. I'm just cutting up Ned Seath's interview to have it ready for you so that I can go on a spring break.
All right. Well, Matt Morgan on a Monday. Thank you very much. Appreciate the visit as always. And have a great week, Matt.
Thanks, Matt. You too.
Looking forward to next Monday. There you have it. Again, just wonderful. Matt has his own way of interviewing and then producing. So well done, and a great addition to All Marine Radio. My thanks to him for doing that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Gunner will join us as we continue here on a Monday, edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug. You can check their entire line of products out at battlemug.com. The Battle Mug starts as a 10-pound block of aluminum milled, machined, and anodized, ready for you to customize. And with Picatinny rails on it, if it's coming indoors, emblems and unit symbols and all kinds of things that you can put on those Picatinny rails. If it's staying in a vehicle for an operator, scopes, lights, all kinds of stuff you can put on it to make it an operational device. So very versatile, one of a kind. You can engrave it on the bottom. Mine certainly is, and has my name, rank, and unit, the blue diamond. So very cool, very cool. 15% off if you go to battlemug.com and use the promo code Marine. And as we told you throughout, it's great for any noteworthy occasion. Birthdays, anniversary, or when you want to get somebody something just really unique that they'll look at and go, wow, where'd you get this? Farewells, promotions, retirements, and then mess night. So check the whole line out, battlemug.com. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.